This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Fruit Loops Season 3, Episode 29. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that we don't hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight white dudes. No, there are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because the news is racist. Allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy. I'm Beth. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to fruitloopspod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294, and we may feature it on a future episode. Also, our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media. Join the discussion by using the hashtag Fruit Loops Pod Discussion or by joining our Facebook group. All of the footnotes for each episode can be found on our website.
And if you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. We also have some merch for sale on our website. But if you can't help monetarily, no problem. You can always give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you get your podcasts from. And be sure to share our show with your friends. So Who are we talking about today, Beth?
Well, this is part 2 of our episode on the Wemmerpan killer, Mayope Cedric Maake, a South African serial killer who committed at least 27 murders throughout 1996 and 1997. So if you're just tuning in, go back and listen to part 1 and we'll meet you right back here.
Yes, we will. So in the meantime, how you doing?
I'm okay. I'm a little worn down, just tired. I've got a lot going on at work right now, so I'm just trying to keep my head above water. And it's exhausting.
Yes, I feel you. Same. It's already spring break.
Yeah.
What the hell?
I know. What happened to January and February?
Yeah, no, like Easter decorations are already coming up. It's like, oh, come on, time, slow down. So now we're going to get into listener letters.
Well, hello, angels.
Hello.
Thank you.
Well, we got a sweet message from Gardenias for Martha on Instagram. And if you recall in our episode on Chiving, we talked about our games we used to play in our childhood, like silly games we would play. And I think I said that me and my friends used to play Iraq War, the first one. And Gardenias for Martha said in her message to us that she and her siblings and cousins used to play drive-by at her aunt's house. Yeah, in Inglewood, which is an LA suburb. It's a very black and brown area. I don't know what gentrification has done to it. But anyway, she said that there was a patch of grass in the front yard, and when they would see headlights coming, they would drop to the ground behind a tree and yell, drive-by! Also, she said Beth's fishing story where everyone else caught cool fish and Beth caught a crappie and hunting corner was really funny. And She said that I proved her point that a gang of white people surrounding a person of color is terrifying. And to that, I say thank you for fucking with us on a regular basis, for supporting with us. She engages with us every week on Instagram. So we love you, boo, and hip hop air horns.
Thank you.
What do you got, Beth?
I just wanted to say thank you so much to all of our patrons. You make it possible for us to do this podcast without going broke. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts. We really appreciate it. Hip hop air horns to all of you.
Absolutely. Well deserved. So we are going to take a quick break and we're going to get to the story when we come back.
I know what you're thinking. How the fuck did we get to this moment? I'm a lover, not a fighter. I am not a monster. I'm just a woman with an uncontrollable urge. I know it's wrong, but why does it feel so good? Would this forever be my fate? We all have skeletons. I just haven't buried all of mine yet. Wanna know my biggest secret? Tune in every Thursday for Kiss, the audio series. Now streaming on most major streaming platforms. See you there.
All right. So, Beth, we're back. Who are we talking about today?
Mayopa Cedric Make, also known as the Wemmerpan Killer, who committed at least 27 murders throughout 1996 and 97. And Make did not discriminate in that he killed people of any age, race, and sex. And he also had five different MOs.
Right. And his crimes took place in South Africa.
Yes.
Which is a hotbed for serial killers, turns out. So now we're going to dive back into the timeline. Splish, splash. Take us there, Beth.
So far, we covered what was later termed the Hammer Series, when Make used a hammer to attack people working in shops. Then he switched to what is called the Wemmerpan Series, when he began attacking couples at Wemmerpan, which is a park with a lake. Then he started the Taxi Series, when he attacked taxi drivers.
Cut to his fourth MO, called the Random Pedestrian Series, is just what it sounds like. He began attacking random people walking down the street. Make did not always stick to the same MO in the same period of time. He often switched back and forth. And if you recall, we left off when on July 18th, 1997, Make killed five people in one day in two different MOs and three separate incidents.
Right. Mm-hmm. Then on July 26, 1997, Haniel Matutsi and Doris Mangafala were walking down the street when they were approached by two men. The men demanded money, then assaulted Haniel and raped Doris. Doris was beaten to death with a rock. They then stole Doris's pants and shoes for some reason. Haniel did survive, and the second man who attacked them is not known.
After this, Make went back to his old Hammer Series MO when sometime in August of 1997, he attacked 64-year-old Luvio Vitone. Vitone was working at a shoe shop in Japestown when Make dropped off some shoes for repair. Make returned the next day to get them, and when he did, he asked about some belts that were hanging behind the counter.
Luvio handed him one, and Make tried it on. Make then pulled out his hammer and hit Luvio in the face with it.
Oh, God.
Luvio lost consciousness. When he woke up, Make was gone, but he'd left behind his bag and the hammer. In the bag, Luvio found shoe polish, an empty wallet, and the shoes that he had just repaired. What a waste of time, motherfucker. He couldn't even take the shoes. And Luvio sold the items before they could be collected as evidence. And this is another case that was probably not reported until later because the man didn't trust the police. That's just my supposition.
Yeah, and I don't think I can disagree with that. On August 16th, 1997, 53-year-old Natvarlal Gangaran was attacked in his tailor shop. Mackie attacked him from behind with a hammer and stole his wallet. Natvarlal survived. Then on August 19th, Aesop Hassan was found in a pool of blood on the floor in his shop. He had been attacked with a hammer around 10:30 that morning, but had no memory of it. He survived.
On the morning of August 29th, 1997, Mackie attacked 56-year-old Kanu Farbu in his tailor shop in Yeovil. Mackie hit him with a hammer and stole his wallet. Kanu, unfortunately, did not survive. Then on September 14th, Abdul Karim was attacked with a hammer in his shop in Forsberg. He fortunately did survive. And then 5 days later, 75-year-old Harjivan Dea was attacked from behind with a hammer. His wallet and a bag of clothes were stolen. He survived.
I just wonder what the news coverage is at this point. Are there articles or is it on the nightly news every day? What's going on?
Right.
On October 4th, 1997, Mackie killed Mohamed Ibrahim while he was working in a shop in La Rochelle. Mohamed sustained severe head and neck injuries, and his body was found by a customer later that day. Cash had been stolen from the register.
On October 14th, Mackie beat Jacinto Serrano to death in a cafe in Turfantine. And on October 18th, Eduardo Augusto was attacked in his shop in Buissons when Mackie hit him in the head with a hammer. Eduardo survived, but Mackie stole Eduardo's ID book and wallet and the entire cash register, which contained 500 rand.
Which, again, is South African currency. The next day, right. Mackie began what was later termed the House Series, his fifth and final MO. These were a series of home invasion robberies. On October 15th, Jose Kairis was stabbed to death in his home in Regent's Park, a suburb of Johannesburg. Mackie stole his television, video recorder, wallet, a pair of shoes, and his keys.
On October 25th, 36-year-old Mahesh Vallabh was working in a tailor shop when a couple came in. The man and woman said they wanted to buy underwear and then attacked Mahesh with a hammer and stole 500 rand before leaving. Mahesh survived.
Sorry, there's a mosquito in here.
Get the motherfucker.
I have the bug spray. I knew he was in here somewhere. I had the bug spray. I got the fly swatter. He's been driving me nuts all day. Anyway.
Did you get him?
I got him.
Whew, good.
What a relief. Okay. back to the story. On November 3rd, Mackie went to the tailor shop of Anil Mehta and left some pants for alterations. The next day, he returned to collect the pants and beat Anil to death with a hammer. His body was found by an employee when he arrived for work. A bag containing two pairs of jeans and an invoice was found on the counter. So now we're going to dive into the investigation. Hit it, Beth.
As we mentioned earlier... In the 90s in South Africa, there was kind of a crime wave, and it was actually not surprising to have two serial killers at work in the same area at the same time. So both the Wemmer Pan series and the Hammer series were thought to be the work of two different men.
Captain Pete Bilveld, if you will recall, had been assigned to the Wemmer Pan series, was assigned to another series to investigate, which was the Hammer series. While investigating the Hammer series, Bilveld came up with a plan to put surveillance on the tailor shops and shoe repair stores in the area, hoping to catch the killer. It's a good plan.
Yeah, it is. But the Asian community, many of whom the victims in the Hammer series belonged to, did not believe that the crimes were being properly investigated by the police, which they probably had good reason to believe that, and they went to the media. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the first time that the crimes had been connected in the media, all of the Hammer series. Mm. And because of all the media attention, Bilveld called off his surveillance, assuming that the perp would stop hitting the stores.
And this is apparently what happened, is Maki went back to his house, Ceres, M.O., when on November 7th, 1997, Arthur McIntyre was beaten to death with a hammer in his home in South Hills. Maki stole a video machine, probably a VHS player, a portable radio, jewelry, clothes, and a .38 caliber revolver.
On the same day that he killed Arthur McIntyre, Maki went into Victoria Fashions in Rosettenville and attacked a Chinese couple, Chan Chow and Ki Chow, with a hammer. He stole some cash and fled. Chan died in the hospital the next day, but Ki survived.
A week later, Maki killed Thakor Ranchod in Boston Taylors. He then switched MOs again when, on November 28th, he attacked a man riding his bicycle at Wemmerpan. Maki shot Gerard Lavu in the back, killing him, then stole Gerard's bicycle and later sold it.
On December 12th, 1997, Maki approached Mini Kabinde and Tande Nadaba while they were in a shack that they had built at Blue Dam Homestead Park. And I tried to find more information about this, but I'm assuming they were homeless. And so they built a little shack.
Like a tent city.
Yeah, kind of a tent city. Maki pretended to be a policeman and told them that he was looking for stolen property. He then searched through their belongings.
He then told them to come with him to his vehicle. Minnie and Tandy followed Maki, and Maki suddenly pulled out his firearm and held it to Minnie's head. He then raped Tandy and afterwards shot and killed Minnie. Later the same day, Maki broke into the home of Cyril Slattery in Terfontein and attacked him with a hammer. After bludgeoning Cyril to death, Maki stole his TV.
2 days later, on December 14th, Enoch Magama, 25, and Delway. God, these names.
These names are hard. These names Delway. Are hard. We're doing our best. Delway.
Delaware and Gagala, 24, were in Moffett View walking through the veld, which is a flat area covered in grass or low shrub, when they were attacked by Maki. He forced them to have sex while he watched. Then he raped Delaware and robbed Enoch of his clothes and watch. But he didn't kill either of them. And it's weird how he picks some people to spare and he kills others. And I wonder what made him do that, what made him choose which ones to spare and not the others.
Me too.
At one point, he even had the audacity to ask one of his rape victims, Dorcas Makatsune, for a date, if you remember in the last episode.
Yeah, I'm puzzled. On December 19th, Bongami Gama and Ntambifuthi Zumalo were walking in Pioneer Park when Maki snuck up on them and from behind. He shot Bongami in the back, killing him, and then took his money. And then he forced Ntambifuthi to walk with him to Wemmerpan, where he raped her twice. Afterwards, he forced her to walk with him again.
As they were walking, they came across two men, Richmond Fabana and another man whose name I could not find. And Maki shot at them. The unknown man escaped, but Richmond was wounded. And Maki went up to him and stole his shoes. In Mickey Pistorius's book, she calls them the shoes. She calls them tackies. She said he stole his tackies. I was like, tackies? What the hell is that? So I looked it up, and it means athletic shoes. So sneakers or tennis shoes, or in the UK, kicks, trainers, or runners. I love all these names for
all
shoes.
These names.
Anyway, Richmond survived. Maki then took Ntumfuthi to Faraday Station, where he raped her again. He then let her go, telling her that she was lucky he didn't kill her. And I guess she was, but damn.
Now, throughout all of this, right, he still has a job and he still has a girlfriend, right? Or a fiance?
Yeah, he has a girlfriend in Johannesburg, and he has a wife and 3 or 4 children back home. So, yeah.
Okay, so meanwhile, Detective Pete Bilveld was able to pull a DNA profile from a tissue found near the scene of one of the Wemmerpan murders. And he was also collecting DNA from the rape victims. That's good. Bilveld spoke to the surviving victims, and they described the killer as a small in stature but strong and very aggressive individual. He would chase the women while swearing at them in Afrikaans. He also bragged to his victims about his other murders.
Bilveld and a female police officer set a trap one weekend at Wemmerpan. They parked in a car pretending to just be another couple spending time together at the lake. They waited in the car for 9 hours.
Oh boy.
But when it started to get dark, Bilveld called it off because he was afraid for his colleague's safety. As they were driving away, they got a radio call that a man had been creeping up the hill behind them. But when the engine started, he fled. So they almost got him. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well. Very thrilling investigation. Now we're going to dive into the arrest. So then in late December 1997, Bilveld caught a break. Whew, thank goodness. A member of the public called in to say that a strange man was lurking around a local hotel. He'd never ate or slept there, but he was always around, and he wasn't a vagrant.
The description that was provided fit the surviving Wemmerpan victim's description of their attacker. He was a small, thin man, neatly clad in green trousers and a gray jersey. The caller also said that he thought he might be in a relationship with a woman who lived in the hotel.
Bilveld found out that the man's girlfriend was a woman named Angelina Tlapane, and she worked at a nearby dog groomer's. On the morning of December 23rd, 1997, Bilveld and his team started surveillance on Angelina. At about 11 a.m., she got into a taxi and traveled towards Japestown.
Near the railway station, she got out and waited on a corner. A small man clad in green trousers and a gray jersey came walking towards her. It was Cedric Maki, and he was taken into custody. Police found a single bullet cartridge in his pocket. Maki refused to say a word. And I think there's got to be more to this, how they figured he must have been the Wemmerpan killer, because just somebody calling and saying there's this guy that's hanging around a hotel, and they're like, sounds like he's the Wemmerpan killer. It just doesn't really connect. So
yeah,
but that's all I know.
There's definitely more to the story. We just don't know it. At the police station, Maki asked to see his wife. Bilveld told him he would arrange it. In the meantime, Bilveld knew that he could only detain Maki for 48 hours, so he arranged for a blood sample so that it could be compared to the DNA profile the police already had for the murder.
Bilveld was called in the middle of the night and told that Maki was basically throwing a fit. He was screaming and throwing feces at his jailers.
Mm.
Yikes.
Well, you know, one of my favorite shows is like Lock Up Abroad.
Right.
And that's something that prisoners do. I mean, when you feel like you have nothing to lose,
or you have nothing to throw.
Yeah.
I got nothing in here. I'm going to poop some out and throw it at you.
Yeah. What else is there to do?
What else are you going to throw? So Bilveld got up and headed to the jail to try to calm Maki down. When he arrived at Maki's cell, Bilveld said, "Can I get you a cold drink? You might as well know you're not getting out of here. You can do what you like, but it would be better not to upset the people around here."
Novel idea. Bilveld spent around 3 hours talking to Maki. At first, Maki behaved very angrily, swearing at Bilveld and repeating over and over that he had no idea what Bilveld was talking about. Eventually, Bilveld said, "I've been so kind to you. I fetched your wife, and I'll bring her again if you want me to, and your mother." And Bilveld was able to make Maki calm down. Calm the fuck down, sir.
Yeah. The technicians at the forensics lab in Pretoria worked right through Christmas so they could have the results ready before the 48-hour deadline was up. Only hours before the cutoff time, the forensic division phoned with the news. The DNA matched. Maki was their killer.
DNA results in hand, Bilveld confronted Maki in his office saying, "Cedric, I know it's you who killed all those people at Wemmerpan, raped the women, and did all those things." Finally, Maki said, "Yes, I did it. It was me."
Bill Veld arranged to take Maki out so he could point out the crime scenes in the company of an independent officer and an interpreter. Maki took them to more than 40 sites, including the one where he had shot, quote unquote, the white man, which was Gerhard Lavoux, beside Weber Pan for his bicycle.
The data generated by this was later used with geographic information systems and crime mapping technology to provide geographic diagrams of the murders. Geographic profiling later revealed that the majority of Maki's murders were centered on two of his residences, the place where he worked and the residences of his brother and his girlfriend. So not where his wife and kids lived.
No, they lived out somewhere else in a different town. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Maki took Bill Veld to a pawn shop in La Rochelle in South Johannesburg, where he had sold the bicycle for 120 rand. The alias that he used on the receipt was Patrick Mwena, the same alias he used to check in a shirt at one of the tailors before Maki murdered him or attacked him.
I see a connection.
Yeah.
Clothing and shoes that he had taken from some of the victims were found on his mother's house in Guyana. Maki took police to a place where he had hidden a pistol that he had used in his crimes.
When Bill Veld asked him why he killed tailors, Maki reportedly said that he once took a garment to a tailor to have work done on it and wasn't happy. Quote, since then, I killed them, unquote.
So one garment wasn't to his liking. And he decided
so
to kill
all tailors.
All of the tailors. It doesn't make no damn sense.
No, does not compute.
But, other things are there's a lot puzzling about this story. That's the least of it. So now we're going to dive into the trial. So Maki pleaded not guilty to 133 charges at his trial, which lasted 11 months and did not end until September of 2000. Remember his spree. Wow. Ended in 1997. Yeah. The Weber Pan serial killer trial was on the earliest uses of geographic information systems to aid in court prosecutions by the South African police.
Surviving female victims testified against him, recalling how he would kick them and scream obscenities at them while they were on the ground. And experts offered graphic explanations of how Maki used large rocks to crush the skulls of some of his victims. One mother whose son was murdered ran from the courtroom sobbing.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
On several occasions, Maki lost control in court. And once he became so angry, he began screaming and banging his head on the dock. I think that means the table or maybe the
place where they keep him while when he's in trial. Like, it's a little different, I think, from the courtrooms that we're used to. For us, it would be a table, but it's more like English courts.
Oh, okay. All right. So six police officers had to carry him out. Sometimes he would refuse to enter the courtroom.
Once during recess, he sneered at state advocate Yolanda Duplessis and threatened her with the same violence he used on his victims. But when his mother was mentioned in court, he would cry.
Well, that's interesting.
He was a little emotional.
There's a lot going on in there. I don't know. I think I was like thinking he needs Oprah. And then I keep thinking about that clip. Did you see Oprah fall on stage?
No, I didn't see that one.
It's so funny.
I think I need to see it.
Oprah is on stage at a conference trying to convince people to sign up for Weight Watchers. And she's talking about balance.
Oh, no.
Balancing your life.
She fell down.
And then second later, she goes,
oh my God,
she goes
how embarrassing.
Down hard.
Oh.
And then she sits up and goes, wrong shoes.
Oh my gosh.
So he might have needed Oprah. That's the only reason why I brought that up. And then I can't. Anytime I think of Oprah now, I just see her.
You start thinking about. I'm gonna look that up
because
that sounds pretty fucking funny.
It is so funny. Okay. Back to more. Not
back
funny
to sad stuff. Yeah.
So at one point in the trial, Judge Geraldine Borchers ordered Maki be removed from the court. On another occasion, she recommended that he be examined by a doctor, and he was prescribed tranquilizers, which he refused to take.
Maki slept as Judge Borchers pronounced him guilty of murdering Jose de Kers by hitting him over the head with his own hammer and stabbing him. While he dozed, de Kers' widow, Mariette, sobbed. Oh, that's pretty sad.
Yeah. On September 6, 2000, he was convicted of 27 murders, 26 attempted murders, 14 rapes, 41 aggravated robberies, and many less serious offenses. He was found guilty of 114 of his 134 charges in all, and he was sentenced to 27 life sentences, amounting to 1,340 years in prison. Is that enough?
He's going to be there for a while.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Families of the victims said they welcomed the sentence. However, one relative said, quote, "If the death sentence was still in place, I would be happier," unquote.
I can certainly understand
why only imagine.
A family member might feel that way. Yeah. So now we're going to get into where are they now? Well, Maki said he would appeal and boasted that he would be out of jail in 2 years, but he is currently still in prison, serving his 1,340-year prison term. Maki's wife and children moved to Giani to live with relatives.
Pete Bielefeld retired from the South African Police Service in 2010 after 38 years of service, starting a private eye business with associates. A biography called Bielefeld, Dossier of a Serial Sleuth was written by Hanley Retief and recounted his career. Regarded as South Africa's top detective, he died in May of 2017.
Oh, well, you know what? I got to say, I don't always have nice things to say about police officers and their investigations, but this guy, I think, did a good job investigating the case and getting to the bottom of it.
Yeah, and apparently he investigated a lot of cases and solved a lot of cases like this.
Yeah, so big ups to that guy. So now we're going to get into what we think made him snap and our takeaways.
So this is a weird one.
Uh-huh.
He had five different MOs, killed whoever, didn't matter what race, sex, or age. He used different methods of killing. He used a hammer, rocks, knives, and a gun. And it seems to me that he was just full of rage.
Yeah.
He kind of reminded me of the baseline killer, just kind of opportunistic in his crimes. Mm-hmm. Just did whatever he felt like doing, whenever he felt like doing it. And he didn't seem like he put a whole lot of thought into it. I mean, he had some plans, but I don't know. He seemed like he just kind of did whatever he felt like doing, really. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to say why he did what he did, especially why he went on this killing spree in such a short period of time.
Yeah.
It's like a year. Mm-hmm. A year.
Yeah.
And as far as we know, he didn't do anything illegal prior to December 1996 when the first attack occurred.
I know, right?
Yeah. It's possible that he did. We just don't know about it. But we don't know about it. So as far as we know, he just started killing people.
Yeah.
And just went nuts for a year. Now, he said he was treated barbarically in his tribe initiation, and he was really angry with his father. But as always, he's not the only one out there with life experiences like that.
Right.
And they don't all become serial killers. So I don't know. I don't know why he did what he did. And it did cross my mind more than once that maybe he didn't do all of these crimes. And it's possible that he didn't do some of them. But they did have DNA and they found evidence at his mom's house. Mm-hmm. And the receipts using the name Patrick Moina, and he took them to crime scenes and the gun. So, I mean, obviously he did a lot of them.
Right.
But as I was reading the story, I was like, I wonder if he didn't actually do these and they just fingered him for all of these crimes just to have somebody to put away. But I think he did do a lot of them.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
I think that he did do a lot of them. I was surprised at how brazen his crimes were. I mean, to kill somebody with a hammer, you have to get like really close to them and like look them in the face. Like,
That's a pretty personal attack.
And a pretty violent, like you have to be willing to go all the way. Like, one blow might not do it. And it's a gruesome way to kill somebody.
Yeah.
And so I wondered about that. And then I wondered about, like, maybe he had a mental break. Maybe there is some event that happened in his life or mental health, and he just snapped because he killed so frequently in that 1 year period of time. It was like the next day, five in one day. It was
he was a killing machine.
He was a machine. And so I wonder what happened that made him snap. God forbid he hadn't been apprehended. I also was blown away by the amount. He was so brazen. His crimes were just so many, so frequent. And he didn't seem to have any remorse either. Until he, you know, heard his mom speak in the courtroom. And I don't know what that's about either. So those are my thoughts.
Yeah.
But I don't disagree with you.
So basically, I don't know.
Yeah. So
it's weird and I don't know.
Yes. If you're looking for answers, don't come here. Try one of those other true crime podcasts. Okay, so now we're going to talk about how not to get murdered. So, if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences. Sometimes we have no suggestions for a particular episode and we'll just offer up generic tips.
So take it away, Beth.
So my tips this time, because Mr. Maki did some home invasions, my tips are about how to stay safe during a home invasion. Mm. So first of all, have a plan and follow it. The best time to think about what you would do in the event of a dangerous situation is before that situation has actually occurred.
Brilliant point.
When it's actually happening, panic and fear can cloud your judgment, which could potentially land you in a dangerous situation. So make your plan ahead of time.
Okay.
Number two is don't confront an intruder. Even if it doesn't look like the intruder has a weapon, physical confrontations are risky and could be deadly. Avoid confrontation unless absolutely necessary. Number three is get as far away from the intruder as possible. Put as much distance between yourself and the intruder as you can. Always try to get out first. So your first thought should be to get out of the house. Mm. Number four, call for help. After you've put distance between yourself and the intruder, call 911.
This is what I've always never understood. So in these movies, right, white ladies always run up the stairs inside the house.
Yeah, and black people, get the hell out.
Nobody with some sense would ever run up the stairs. You gotta get out of the house.
Get out of the house.
What is wrong with these white ladies in these movies? It's crazy.
I don't know.
Okay. Don't be like them.
Yes. Don't be like the white lady in a horror film.
Don't do it.
So if the intruder starts running away from your home, let them go.
Yes.
Personal safety expert and CEO of Saber Security Equipment Corporation, David Nance, says, quote, "Let them leave if they're trying to leave. Your safety and that of your loved ones is most important. So don't be a hero. Yes. Let them leave." Mm-hmm. Defend yourself if necessary, but make a plan first. That means now.
Okay.
Make sure that you have the tools to defend yourself. Experts suggest having easy-to-use methods of self-defense, such as pepper spray or pepper gel. Or if you're comfortable and trained, a firearm, readily available in the event that you need to defend yourself. But don't keep a gun if you don't know how to use it, or if you're not sure if you can use it. It could easily be taken from you and used against you.
That's right.
David Nance says, quote, "I'm a big advocate of defending yourself at a distance. Home defense pepper gel is an excellent option. The pepper gel does not atomize like traditional pepper sprays, and it only affects what it directly contacts. And you can purchase Pepper Gel on Amazon, SaberRed.com, Dick's Sporting Goods, Home Depot, and lots of other places. Just ask Googleisha where you can buy Pepper Gel, and she will tell you. So once you have your plan in place, practice it with your family often. Have a plan of how to leave the house and where to meet up after leaving and for calling the police. Figure out a room or places where you can all go to hide if the situation warrants, if you can't get out. Figure out a word to say to execute the plan. Don't overcomplicate it and make it something that's too hard to remember. Something like escape. Works fine.
Good one. So I practice with my kids, like when we come home, you know, and it's dark outside, like, do you see anybody who wants to kill us? Or like, we'll do practice like zombie apocalypse drills. So where we all have to like climb on the car.
Good idea. Yeah. Make it into a game.
Yeah.
And of course, prevention is key. Make your home less of a target. Don't make it obvious when you're home alone. Always make sure that your house is well lit. Stay on your guard when strangers come to your door and be extremely cautious when deciding who to let inside. If someone you don't know knocks at your door, you can give the impression that there are other people at home with you by yelling out, "I'll get it," before opening the door, or just ask who is there through the door. You can also install a security screen to keep a barrier between you, or a Ring video doorbell so you don't have to make yourself vulnerable by opening the door at all.
Right.
Make sure that your home is as secure as possible and lock every goddamn thing.
I've already heard the truth. I don't need it. You know, when the Jehovah's Witnesses come over, I already know. Go to the next house.
Yeah. I haven't found my Lord and Savior, so.
I'm already saved. So now we are going to get into the part of our show where we shout out any content by people of color, any marginalized groups, or any true crime goodies. So I just wanted to shout out a documentary on Netflix, The Trials of Gabriel Fernandez. You might have by now already heard our crossover episode that we did with our pod play cousins over at Affirmative Murder. And it is a horrifying, heartbreaking, but necessary story because this poor baby literally just fell through the cracks of the system. And so did the coverage of his death because he was a poor Latinx brown kid. So check that out.
Yeah, it was really good. I wasn't sure if I could watch it because it involved the torture and death of a child. And I find that kind of disturbing.
To say the least. It was a tough watch, but I think everybody needs to see it.
Yeah, and I got through it, so I think you guys can too.
Yeah. What do you got, Beth?
I wanted to recommend the movie Parasite, which you might have heard of because it won Oscar for Best Picture.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the president didn't like it because it wasn't in English.
Right. He can't read, so it was hard for him to watch. I don't know if I would have known about this movie if it hadn't won the Oscar. I hadn't heard anything about it until the Oscars.
Interesting.
So,
okay.
I'm really happy that I did hear about it because it was really good. It's the first non-English language film to win Best Picture. It's a Korean movie, and I don't know if I've ever watched a Korean movie before. Have you?
I don't think so. No.
But I don't think I have either. I've watched Chinese movies, Japanese movies, French movies, other ones too, but I don't think I've watched a Korean movie before, and I really enjoyed it. So I think I'm going to be looking for some more.
Yeah.
I used to watch a lot of foreign language films years ago. I haven't recently because I've been so busy and you have to really pay attention because you have to read. So I haven't watched a lot recently, but I used to really watch a lot of them because they definitely have a different perspective than American movies.
Yeah.
American movies tend to be moralistic and foreign films aren't as moralistic. They tell stories with realistic and flawed characters, but it's okay. American movies, they want their good people to be good and their bad people to be villains, and it's all spelled out, you know, there's mm-hmm. no nuance. Mm-hmm. And so I enjoy that. Not the American movies.
There is a lot of nuance in all of these characters, which
yes.
It was really, really cool to see.
Yeah. And it was a really good movie. And my friend who watched it said she didn't think she'd ever seen a movie like it. And I don't think I have either.
Yeah, I think I would have to agree with that. Who's this friend of yours? Can we go to lunch?
I'm sure we could. I'm sure she's dying to meet you. So
let's do it. Let's go fill our bellies with garbage again. times are hard over here.
Yeah. So Parasite is on Amazon right now for like $6. And today they're running a sale. So it's $4. But ooh. I don't know if that'll be still on when this airs. But yeah, it's pretty cheap. So watch it.
Yeah, it's very, very good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for that shout out.
Sure.
Well, that's it for this week and for the season, actually. We're going to be taking a break until April. And then we will be getting right back at it. So don't worry. Also, we have decided to abandon the season, quote unquote, format going forward. So we're just going to be having numbered episodes. So we're almost at 100. We will take short quarterly breaks. Just, you know, we're just human beings just like you. So just so we don't lose our goddamn minds. And then we just will get right back at it whenever we can.
Yeah.
So thanks for rocking with us. Thanks for listening to us. But in the meantime, Beth, where can the people find us?
Our website is FruitLoopsPod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod. And our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. And links to our sources will be in our footnotes. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App. Or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help. We also have merch on our website now at fruitloopspod.com/merch.
That's right. Everything Beth said is 100% true. This is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday.
Except for when we're on break.
Except for when we're on a goddamn break. But until then, look alive, guys. It's crazy out there. Thank you.